Hey there, everybody. It is Wednesday, July 4th, 2012. Happy Independence Day, y'all, which you are celebrating by listening right this very second to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. We have just an absurdly fun episode for you this week, and we, of course, want all your feedback, so send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. And, of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a ton of guests this week who are doing some really fun things with some absurdly nifty ventures, so I say we get started. Hey, first guest, are you ready to go?
Sure.
Okay, that's a good thing. Let me introduce you. The creator of Drink and Drag, Kelly Murphy, is introducing us to a totally new concept in the way that the gays and their straight friends play. Located in glorious Las Vegas, which I've never been to, which we'll talk about, Kelly, and staffed by America's best drag queens, Drink and Drag features 12 lanes of bowling, pool tables, dart boards, a VIP area, and some scrumptious eats. He is also the owner of Crave, dubbed the number one gay nightclub in the USA. Kelly Murphy, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like you are the first club owner we have ever had in 4 years of This Show Is So Gay, and I'm fascinated by this.
Why do you think it's been so long?
I don't know, but we're breaking that curse right now, so no pressure. Kelly, I know nothing about how one gets into this line of work. How did you arrive at where you are?
I actually got thrown out of Crave.
Nice.
Because I was in VIP and misbehaving. And
is there more to that story that we need to know?
Probably not.
We'll leave it there. Okay.
It had something to do with whipped cream and one of the servers not wearing a shirt.
Okay.
In any case, I went back the following week and was told I'd been 86, and I had no idea what being 86 from a club meant.
Okay.
And I found out that I couldn't go back in. So I got a hold of a manager who put me in touch with the owner, and not too long after that, I bought it.
Look at that. Now, did you tell people I'm gonna buy this club?
No, I kind of invested in it and did it, a little more discreetly.
Okay.
I didn't want to be too obnoxious.
You didn't want to be too obnoxious. Now, I've never been to Crave. What would I experience were I to go there?
Crave is basically a dance club. It's about 15,000 square feet. We accommodate about 1,500 gay lesbians on Fridays and Saturdays, and then the counts are a little bit less during the week.
Okay.
But, we have a stage and have aerialists that swing from the ceiling.
Holy cow.
Breathe fire and people running around. It's chaos.
All right. But the chaos you would kind of come out to see.
Yeah, I think it's fabulous.
Drink and Drag, I was reading all about it online. I am fascinated by this. Now, I often talk on the show about how we need more places where there's actually stuff to do, where it's not just about gays congregating around alcohol, that there are actually other things to do. And that's why I love this concept, and I wanted to have you on the show. Tell everyone about Drink and Drag, where the idea came from.
I crossed Drink and Drag when I was looking for some real estate for a second club in Las Vegas. And it was a large space. It had some bowling alley in it. And I attempted about 3 years ago to try to develop the concept. And right as that process was moving along, the economy tanked. And I basically just kind of pulled back, and we held out for a bit. And then last year, I went back to that same location and struck a deal to take the space. And what intrigued me about it was that it had a bowling alley. It had pool tables. And it was downtown Las Vegas, which is a interesting crowd of people to begin with.
Okay.
So I felt I needed a good catch to get people down there, and I didn't want to open another dance club. Like you, I was looking for something where people could go and not have to dance and not have to have really loud music, just a little more casual. And so that's kind of how it was born.
And how did you find the drag queens to work there at Drink and Drag?
The drag queens were a little more difficult. I had owned at one time a franchise called Lucky Chang's here in Las Vegas.
Okay.
Which is the same as the one in New York.
Which I have been to that many times.
But the licensing deal with them, I pulled the plug on that a couple years ago for a variety of reasons, but mainly I just didn't like the operation and it just wasn't fun anymore. And so I always wanted to do something else with drag queens and maybe a little different environment that didn't involve food and so many other difficulties. And this just seemed like the perfect fit. So, you know, we started running ads and we interviewed a ton of them. Then we set up a little area for them to perform with a bunch of judges who basically rated them all, and we just kind of worked our way down from that.
Nice.
I think we're at 28 or 32 at the moment.
Wow. That's quite the roster.
It is quite the roster. We really built a phenomenal dressing room for them. And there's a costume making department with a designer and three sisters. And so all their costumes are pretty much made for them. It's a little difference when you're a drag queen and you have to be tucked and prepped for 6 to 8 hours a day. So it's a little more strength in things.
So what kind of feedback have you gotten on Drink and Drag? What are the patrons saying?
The patrons love it. Drink and Drag has received nothing but phenomenal press. In fact, we've put all of it up on our website. And we just won Las Vegas Weekly's 2012 Best Downtown Hotspot.
Nice.
Which is excellent for being open two months.
Yeah. Now, I have, as I said in the intro, I have never been to Las Vegas. I think I'm a little intimidated by Las Vegas, and I say this as a New York City guy. What would appeal to me about Las Vegas?
I think Las Vegas is just fun.
Yeah.
I think you can come, you can be up. I mean, it's a little different from New York because New York is a much later running town as well, but, you know, we're open 24 hours a day, and Crave is open till 8 a.m. in the morning.
Wow.
Until the last person stumbles out. You know?
Holy cow.
Drink and Drag, yeah. Drink and Drag, we usually close around 4, 5 in the morning.
Okay. But again, what I love about this is that there's all these, tell people all the different things you can do. You can go bowling, which, as a New Jersey native, that's just part of my heritage, so that's enjoyable.
With 12 lanes of bowling, we have 5 pool tables, we have air hockey, we also have a gamer room for playing PlayStation. You can play online or you can play against the other people in the room. We have 12 PlayStation stations with vibrating chairs that move and sound in the headrest.
Yeah.
There's a dance floor. We have a real limited snack menu for people who get hungry. And then the drag queens basically break into song or lip sync every 30 minutes.
Wow.
And it's usually a themed night. So we do White Wedding, where they're all in wedding dresses. We have an 80s night. Last night I think was Broadway. So they do show tunes. So each night we try to theme it up a little bit. We bring in a lot of RuPaul drag queens.
That's what I was seeing. Now, we've had many drag racers on This Show Is So Gay. People, I would assume, show up to see the drag racers.
They do. You know, I think it's just, you know, it's hard to ascertain what the appeal of RuPaul's drag race is.
Right.
Except that there's so much character in drag queens. I mean, I think it takes a very unique person who wants to change their entire appearance and act a completely different way than sometimes they are during their day-to-day life.
Right.
And, you know, they are a group into themselves.
Yeah. Oh, I would imagine.
You probably know. We just have Lady Bunny, who I adore here this weekend, so she's always a very good draw. I just think with RuPaul's, you know, RuPaul hit a good show with that.
Yeah. No, it's some of my favorite entertainment out there. Now, one of my favorite topics, we've actually talked about this quite a bit over the past couple of years. You know, I moved from New York City to Vermont, where there is not one gay bar in the state of Vermont. Not one right now. I'm not saying that you should come here and open one, but I kind of am saying that you should come here and open one. But beyond that, I've often said on the show, you know, I kind of miss having a place, a gay club, a gay bar, a place that I knew that I could go to where we could all congregate. And I've gotten a lot of flack for that from some of our listeners who say, you know, it should be normalized and we don't need gay bars. We don't need gay clubs, all clubs. We should all just be integrating. And at the same time, I don't know. I struggle with that concept. I like the idea of a gay club, of a gay bar, a place that we can go.
Well, I think it depends on your objective for going out. But if your objective is just to be social, then I think Vegas is definitely very receptive to gays and lesbians at any of the bars and nightclubs.
Yeah.
If you're out trying to find the man of your dreams, then I think that there is some advantage to them being in the location where everybody of like mind is. That.
Right. But I also think, and I would press further, I would also say that you also can find that kind of sense of family. You know, as for those of our listeners or who, you know, have struggled with their coming out processes and unfortunately are going through some family withdrawal and some family separation, there is that sense at a gay bar, at a gay club of family that you might not necessarily get someplace else.
I think that that's true in some respect. I mean, one of the things that I've definitely noticed in the nightclub business, especially the gay nightclub business, is with the advent of Grindr and Jaxx and some of the other apps that are on phones, it's much harder to get people to leave their homes to come out. So you really have to make it a visually stimulating event that draws them out, something that groups of them can come out who just want to dance, and a place where they just feel comfortable and can kind of let their hair down. And I think that's the beauty of gay clubs, but only if we keep reinventing the way we develop them.
Wow, that sounds like you've had to work a lot harder these days.
It's much harder, I think, than it was 7 years ago when Crave started.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Joel, one of the founders of Grindr, I blame him for that.
Okay. And what does he reply?
Yeah, he knows.
he owns it. He knows it.
He knows, yeah. I have a new club called Boys that opens in a couple of months, and it kind of takes it a little bit different. It's a hardwood floor, white wall, non-smoking, cool art on the wall from like Tim Burton and Dr. Seuss, and it's just kind of a place where you just go and hang out and kind of live music, but, you know, like maybe a guitarist or a singer or something. And it's even taken it another step out of the dance clubs to try to get people to leave their homes and go out and be social in an environment they're comfortable in.
And to be clear, because we this is a topic that is often covered here, you could go to Drink and Drag and have an amazing time and not have any alcohol the whole night, could you not?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. That's because that's
a
big
piece.
There's
always a lot going on.
Great. Well, that's so good. Now, the big question is, Kelly, how do I get into the VIP area?
Drink and Drag. Drink and Drag's pretty easy.
Okay.
You have to show up and say you want VIP. But there's a variety of ways. But we have VIP hosts that are there. I don't charge a cover at Drink and Drag.
Okay.
So it's really something where you can just come in and hang out, have a drink, and meander about if you want. It's a large space. It's 24,000 square feet. So
okay.
It's easy to kind of get lost in it.
I just want VIP status. That's all I'm asking for.
Well, you just have to call me.
All right.
I have a couple connections. I have a couple strings I can pull.
You know some people.
Yeah.
And their party packages. I just love this. There's just so many different things to do. And I have to say, I'm fascinated by the gamer room, which you covered. Just this place where people can leave their house, because I just got back from China, and it was a phenomenon that I hadn't really seen yet in the U.S. as much, of these, like these gamer lounges where it kind of feels like your parents' basement in a way. And some of my trip mates were saying, oh gosh, it's so dark and dreary. But at the same time, I'm thinking, hey, look, these people left the home and they might not have left the home otherwise.
Well, surprisingly, I was amazed at the amount of gay gamers.
Yeah.
For some reason, it just didn't click in my brain that it was going to do tremendous numbers, but it has been very popular. Ours isn't quite as dark. We have a lot of neon in there, but they're 120-inch high-definition screens, and the sound's amazing, so it's done quite well.
What are the gay gamers drawn to? What are they playing these days?
Gosh, I have no idea. That's the wrong question. I want to say Mortal Kombat, but I could be wrong.
I think you might be wrong on that one. That's okay.
I'm too old. I miss the whole gamer kind of thing. I could never go in and play the games. I'd love to, but I wouldn't last very long.
Any upcoming events that we should know about?
I don't know that we have any special events per se. We have, I take that back, we do. Well, you know, we have Chanel from RuPaul's Drag Race. She does So You Think You're a Drag Queen every Sunday.
Love Chanel.
It's really a lot of fun, yeah. And she puts on a show and she reads some of these. I mean, she tries to be nice, but she does read some of these aspiring drag queens. And then we're doing a huge event for Pride in September, first week of September, where we're actually, there's kind of a big open area outside. So we have a bunch of entertainers coming in for that, including Lady Bunny again. So that'll be kind of outside after the parade, and then people can kind of migrate upstairs.
Awesome. Again, I just love the idea of this. I love the idea that especially I wasn't even thinking in the advent of some of these apps that are keeping people at home. The idea that you can go out and find community and do it in so many different ways, whether you're a gamer, whether you're a bowler, which everyone should be a bowler. How quality of a bowler are you, Kelly Murphy?
I will never admit to being very good, but I'm pretty good.
All right.
But then again, I was there. I was just overseeing everything for about 6 or 7 months. And so as they were working on the lanes and making repairs, the guy would come out and say, okay, I need people to just keep bowling to make sure everything's working and put them through their paces. So I got in a lot of free bowling time.
Wow.
But it was work-related.
Kelly, if that comes up again, will you call me? Because that's a New Jersey gay boy's dream.
Is it really?
Okay, just mine. Maybe it's just mine. It's very exciting. I really perked up there. The free bowling in Vegas at Drink and Drag, and Chanel might show up. I'm there.
Chanel's there every Sunday.
Look at that.
We have Derek Barry, who's a local here. I think he performs every Friday. So we always try to have a special guest on the weekends. But, I mean, 28 to 32 drag queens all jumping up on the tables to lip sync, choreographed, by the way.
Yes.
Is a pretty amazing feat.
Kelly, what motivates you to open all these places?
I don't know, but I would say that it's probably ego. Is that bad?
No, it's fine.
I really would like to have 90% of the gay nightlife market in Las Vegas.
Okay.
Because I think I can create a lot of different events that when people come, they'll truly have a good time.
That's fantastic. Do you feel like, all right, I have enough clubs right now, or are your eyes already looking for the next thing?
I announced July 25th, and this hasn't been announced to anybody, by the way, but July 25th, I'm going to build the largest gay club in the world.
Wow.
In Las Vegas.
What's the biggest one right now?
I don't know.
I'm just thinking, what do you have to beat?
Heaven used to be the largest out of in England, but I'm going to be 80,000 square feet, so I may be very well the largest club in Las Vegas at 80,000. I think Marquee's 50,000.
All right.
Yeah, 5 dance floors, a VIP room.
That's going to be quite the project.
And that's going to piss off New York, because I'm going to try to make Vegas the number one most traveled gay destination in the U.S. Right now it's New York.
Awesome. Well, I'm telling you, never been to Vegas. I'm tempted. I'm not so much into the gambling thing, so I like the idea that we have these places I can go to that just do all these other things. And again, VIP status, free bowling, I'm all set.
Vegas is great. You know, there's shows, we have fantastic dining, there's great pool parties that everybody goes to on Saturdays and Sundays during the day. It's really a spectacular place.
Awesome. All right. Next time in Vegas, we're all going to Drink and Drag. Kelly Murphy, keep opening up these places. Again, I love the fact that you are creating places for folks to come together, for people to find community, to meet other folks, to just, again, the idea that you can meet someone that you've never met before, whether they're a soulmate or a new friend or a new bowling buddy, or, again, I don't think it's Mortal Kombat, but maybe some other game that you get to play together. It's a pretty cool thing that you're doing.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
All right. You're going to keep opening places. You're going to keep bringing people together.
I am. I'm staying in Las Vegas, though.
All right.
I'm going to go outside of Las
Vegas. Yeah, but are you thinking maybe a little bit right now? Gosh, I kind of want to open a big Vermont club.
Not at the moment.
Okay. I'm trying here, man. I'm trying on behalf of all the Vermonters.
I adore Vermont, but Yeah.
We'll get there. We'll get there. Yeah. Two more interviews. The Vermont Club is coming. I'm just telling you, you could open the biggest gay club in Vermont and it could be someone's living room and you would already win.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Kelly Murphy, a pleasure speaking with you. We will all have to come on over and check out Drink and Drag.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
Must be the clothes or the lack thereof. Must be the way they spin a bottle of vodka. Must be the lights, a dark and dim. Must be the way they lean on him. Tell me, why do I always fall in love with a bartender, bartender? Some kind of charm coming from behind the bars of the bartender.
All right, folks, and we are back. I'm already predicting that this is going to be somewhat of a silly segment. Yes? No?
I'm not silly.
No?
I'm very, very serious.
But I am.
Okay. All right. Well, I think first and foremost, because folks don't know your voices, who's here with me?
Jane Baker.
And Sandy Klein.
What are we talking about today? I assume that we are talking about Tom and Katie's divorce.
I am obsessed and can only assume that, are they getting divorced?
Yeah. You pulled that off for a couple of seconds there.
I did hear. Someone said to me, did you hear about Tom and Katie? And I didn't. It was one of the kids, and I didn't ask.
It's very upset. How about Anderson? Do you want to talk about Anderson?
Not a shock.
Not a shock?
Not a shock. No, his mother was Gloria Vanderbilt. Or still is, if she's
still
alive.
She's still alive. don't kill her. Don't kill her.
Anderson Cooper, hello.
I feel ashamed. I should
Anderson Cooper came out this week. Oh, turns out he's gay.
Turns out, fact is, I'm gay.
There you go.
And fact is, I'm gay.
Yeah.
Fact is, I knew that a long time ago.
And was anybody upset?
I don't think so.
I haven't seen anybody upset yet. Huh? But that's not what we're here to...
Sarah Palin will have a word or two about it.
But he's not going to get dropped from any networks or anything like that, so it'll be...
No. His mother is Gloria Vanderbilt.
Yes.
Try to drop him.
Do you guys own any Vanderbilt jeans?
In the 80s, I did not.
And is that a secret?
The 70s and 80s, I did not own anything fashionable, and I've continued on with that.
Okay.
As a style choice.
You're committed to that.
I'm committed to not really having any labels that I know of.
All right.
I make my own.
Okay. Do you make your own clothes? Ever?
I know. No, I never make them, but I rip off any label that's there.
Okay.
And I put my own label on.
Nice.
Yeah. Lesbian clothes, diaper, just whatever I feel like. Yeah.
Brilliant.
I label my kids.
What's the logo? Is there a logo?
Lesbians are us.
Yes. Okay.
Gay fashion. Diasto. What's that?
Nice.
Feniciato. I'm as clueless as I am about fashion terms as I am about fashion.
Well, I'm imagining our listeners are thinking, what's going on?
What the hell's wrong?
Who are these people?
Case.
Are we all Brattleboroites here? Brattleboroites? What are we called?
I'm an import, but I don't know what...
Everyone's an import.
That's on the other side of the yin-yang. I grew up in New Hampshire, but I'm really a Vermonter at heart.
Okay.
I'm a Vermonter now.
Jane, you're a Vermonter now. Are you a Vermonter at heart?
At heart, and yes, and I'm Vermont strong. If somebody could tell me what that means.
Wow.
I don't know, but my license plate says it. It's good for the economy.
Okay,
so folks, you can get Vermont Strong license plates. We'll endorse all sorts of causes.
Cool.
But, so we three live in Brattleboro, but you two, not a project I'm working on, it's a project you two are working on.
That's correct.
I say we make a TV show.
Good. How about we call it 110 Land F?
Tell everyone, Jane Baker,
about
110 Land F.
Well, 110 Land F actually started out as, my mother passed away in 02. There were a lot of things unsaid between us that I thought, would have been nice, like a dramatic death scene. Didn't happen. And I thought, I don't want my kids, I have two sons, I don't want them growing up and wondering what was my childhood, what happened, I don't want any questions unanswered. So I started to just keep, not a diary as much as just memoirs and posted them on my website, no real access to them. But for my kids, when they grew up,
mm-hmm.
and every once in a while, I'd toss them out to writer friends that I have, and they'd be like, "Actually, this is quite good." And I'd say, "Oh, that's sweet of you to say." And they say, "No, I really mean it's good." So I was like, "Oh, okay then." And the more I thought about it, and the more I kept revisiting my childhood, the more I kept the more it occurred to me that I really did have an unusual childhood. And I guess you start to figure that out when people hear about your childhood and they say you're making it up. Then you start to think, okay, so maybe it's not as believable as it was. But it was an unusual childhood.
How many children in the family?
7 Irish Catholic children.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Every single one of them Irish Catholic?
Yes, from 2 very Irish Catholic parents.
And you were number?
5.
You were number 5 of 7.
First girl.
First and only, or are there more?
No. There was one that redeemed the gender for my mother, and that would have been my sister.
Now,
we should
just pause right here. I'm going to need you to go slow. Okay. I am the youngest of 4 New Jersey Jews. So
So outside Philadelphia Catholics, Irish Catholics.
It's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. Okay. So we never said Baruch Atah Adonai. We said our
I don't think we did either. Just
no. we
said different things.
I found out recently that people who are in other Christian religions read the Bible. And Catholics don't. I mean, maybe some do, but we didn't. I mean, it was read to us in church on Sundays, 3 pieces. But other people I know who are in more extreme Christian religions actually read it from cover to cover.
Yeah.
I hear it's a good story.
I read 1 of the 2 books.
Right. I should try it.
I like things old and vintage. I don't like things new. So that whole New Testament thing.
I like things open to interpretation.
Yes.
So that you could use it for
any
reason. Vintage. 1970s clothes.
Yeah.
Yes, 1970s. Yes, yes, yes. Well, my childhood started in 1962 and is going to end, I guess, when I die. But the story begins when the character that is Mary Jo, not Mary Jane, that's me,
right,
is 13 and goes, my view, the long term for the series, is that the series would end sometime after my second brother who died his death, which was in 86. So I don't know at what point you jump a couple years or this or that, but that's like the main focus of it, is from when my brother David started getting very sick until my brother Patrick's death. They both had Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, mm-hmm. which is hereditary, and I had 5 brothers, so theoretically, all 5 could have had it, but 2 had it, and I became aware at a very young age that, we were not going to live forever, and so I was a bit more serious than a lot of people, but used humor to try to keep some levity in the house.
Did everyone in the house.
As did everyone in the house, yes. My parents, but my mother had a very crisp wit, and you didn't want to be the subject of the biting part of the wit. But she was very witty. And my father was just a silly man, like just a silly, silly guy. And I brought a friend home that I was so proud was going to meet my dad because I adored my dad. And this friend was like a mentor and was directing a show I was in. And my father, was upstairs. And I said, Dad, I'd like you to meet this friend of mine. And he comes down and he's got boxer shorts with hearts all over it. I'm like,
nice.
A, where did you get them? Why? And B, why? And we were always just playing jokes on each other. And we just had a wonderful childhood, all things considered.
A lot of humor there.
A lot of humor, yes. It was a very funny house to grow up in. And lots of funny misunderstandings and silliness that are the key points of episodes.
So you're writing these memoirs, and people are saying, this is really good. You should turn this into more.
Yeah. And then the idea was what more?
Right.
In what form? And some people were thinking book. And I kind of feel like even in an email, you're not sure what the text means.
Right.
It can mean a lot of different things. And since I'm very, very attached to what it means,
mm-hmm.
I wanted to see it acted out. So then is it a stage play? But really, can you cover that many years in a stage play? I don't think so. And what I have found out is that in terms of TV episodes, you become more and more fond of characters. So that it's hard to believe that you would set up a television series season to open with the character that is pretty much based on me, finding out that her brother is in fact dying, not just very sick. And the last episode of the first season would be his death. And, all the weirdness that would surround a 13-year-old trying to handle and get a grasp on that.
So how much have you written? How much is...
The pilot episode is written.
Okay.
And that's really kind of key because you have to... there's 2 different kinds of pilots. There's the episodic pilot, which means you watch this week and next week it continues.
Right.
And then there's the procedurals, like Law and Order. Every week you kind of know there's a crime, happens in the cold open. They investigate it, then they prosecute in the end. So in the first episode of a TV series, you have to lay out all the main characters that they're going to get to know. And so that is kind of like the biggest deal for me.
Oh,
all the episodes, the concepts in the episodes flow really simply for me after that.
Because you got to get people hooked.
You have to have them hooked, and that's why the character of Mary Jo will be played by someone incredibly adorable.
Well,
because it's based on, you know, me.
Yeah, and someone I would hope is modest.
Right. That's very important. I don't want any overinflated egos.
Right.
And on the set, because frankly, that's annoying.
It's annoying.
Yeah, I don't like that.
So, and you just wandered into the interview, or you have a part in all of this?
Well,
I saw Jane going, and I followed her.
I've been sort of going along with Jane with this for about 3 years, right?
About that, yeah.
3 years. When I first started hanging out with her, she showed me the memoirs, so we went just from there up to now, and we've just been talking about it as an art, you know, artistically, mm-hmm. what it would look like, because that's sort of my thing, because I work at a theater and I have a visual sense of the piece, and I also have a mission around it, my own feelings about how important it is for the world to see young children discovering themselves, discovering their orientations, mm-hmm. and things like that. So so it's been important for me to be part of it, we've had some really nice discussions about what it looks like. Yeah. I mean, the opening scene,
nice.
I imagine one of the scenes, this girl, Mary Jo, sort of journals a little bit herself.
Mm-hmm.
So she uses a cassette, you know, the old 70s cassette player, and she'll talk into that. And she sort of journals a little bit in her closet. She has a closet. And so one of the things that...
She's actually
literally
in the closet.
Yes.
And she doesn't know it. I mean, Mary Jane doesn't know at 13
years
old.
We, the audience, know.
Yeah.
Well, she's starting to catch on.
There's little things that happen. But so she's in her closet, and what you see is her there, you know, sort of hunkered down with her cassette recorder, and she's talking into it. But over her head hang all of these dresses with tags still on them hanging down around her head. So that sort of image of... I'm not my mommy's daughter. I'm not wearing the dresses.
Right.
That kind of thing. So those are the kind of images we talk about a lot, like the very opening image of her, you know, being the daughter that's always coming down and helping the boys turn in the middle of the night, and just things
right.
like that, what that looks
you
like.
Know, well, in the event that any of my siblings are gay and never told me and hear this broadcast, I want to be clear, we all had an equal part in caring for my brothers. It's just that the story is told through my eyes, and it begins one evening when I'm the one who woke up. So, I never, until I left my home to go to college, slept a night through without hearing what was going on in the house.
Yeah,
because, part of the disease, it's a very quickly progressive degenerative disease. So by the time my brothers were 10 and 9, they were in wheelchairs for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
And by the time they were 13, 14, they no longer could feed themselves. So it was, you know, they needed total care. And every single person in our family played a part in it. And this is just telling the story through my eyes because I don't have the other, you know, siblings' eyes. And ironically, I mean, I really feel that lots of people can go through the same experience and come out with different feelings about it. And I have my one younger brother, who will just tell people we had a wonderful childhood and leave it at that.
Yeah.
And for him, that's his truth, that it was a wonderful childhood. And I, you know, there are points where I say, yes, I would not trade knowing them and loving them for the pain that it caused to lose them. I wouldn't want to do without any of it because it builds who you are. But the gay part is interesting because so many people are like, what's your coming out story? And it's all about them outside of the context of what was going on in mm-hmm. their lives other than that. And I didn't really seal the deal metaphorically until I was in college.
Yeah.
Because it was the first time I really had to think about, well, who am I really? Other than Pat and Dave's sister and, you know, Joe right. and Dolores' daughter, who am I? And that's when I really started to realize, in retrospect, you know, I dated this boy until I was in like seventh grade, I was in love with his sister. And any reason to go over there to his house was a good idea. And, you know, later I was able to look back and go, oh, so
painfully obvious.
There's one scene where I would just go make out at Bobby's. And I was, you know, making out with Bobby. And in this scene, she's making out with Bobby. But they're, you know, they're 13 years old. They're not doing anything.
Right.
These days, kids do.
These
damn
days.
Kids. So, but it was pretty innocent kissing. And it's a lot of silly, like, we were actually playing war before we started kissing. And I had a rifle and all. And then the visuals are sort of like that. He wants me to play this nurse kissing. And I'm like, no, I'm a soldier. So, you know, then you're gay. And he was just like, that's stupid. And I don't care. And so we were just kissing. But then his sister walks in the room. And from the point of view of the camera, my vision is that I'm kissing the sister, not him. And then he kind of shakes me out of it. He's like, that's not like you. And I'm like, sure is. What are you talking about?
So my assumption is you have a good idea for a pilot, a unique idea for a show. It's well written. You have an artistic direction. Everything's all together. My assumption is these things just fund themselves.
Yes. Actually, we've had to turn away millions of dollars. And once I got rid of all that money, I realized I have to start back at scratch.
Ah.
So, TV shows cost an enormous amount of money. One network situation comedy is about $500,000 to $1 million an episode. I've been very lucky. I have some friends in high places and connections, and I've come to believe that it's okay to lean on those because that's how everybody gets things done. I have a very good friend, Monica Horan Rosenthal, who is was on Everybody Loves Raymond, and she played Amy.
Oh, I love Amy.
Who doesn't love Amy?
Best friend from
where? I truly love Amy.
Oh my gosh.
Really. I love Amy.
Isn't she married to the
executive producer, yeah. Phil? Yes.
Yeah.
The first time Phil and I met, we had an intense argument about whether or not Body Double, the movie with Melanie Griffith,
yes,
was a ripoff of someone else. And I just loved the movie so much, I think because of the outfit Melanie was wearing, that I was just so mad at this guy. And I was like, Monica, he's not for you. And she went, I love him. And I'm like, he doesn't understand Body Double. And she luckily took my advice as crap and ended up marrying the fellow. He's a sweetheart of a guy. And
can I just say again, I love Amy.
Everybody loves Amy. Everybody.
I really feel the episodes were so much better when Amy was there. But yes, go ahead.
You know what?
She's so excited for Amy to be on a future episode of this show is so gay.
Yeah. Oh, she would do it. She would so do it. Funny story, when I moved out to Hollywood after Monica had moved out and was trying to, you know, do a little career. At that time, Katie Lang was just coming out. Ellen was still on the horizon. She wasn't, yep, and I'm gay anywhere. And I looked gay. And I would get calls for auditions for Katie Lang lookalikes, like along those lines. And at that time, I had similar features, but they've all gone to hell, let's face it. But at that time, it would happen. So I'd show up, and they'd be like, so you look like Katie Lang a little bit. And I'd be like, we have black hair.
Yeah.
So that's about it. But I moved out there to Hollywood. What was I saying? Monica?
Monica, you're probably talking about what Monica said to you.
I feel this is what you do, right? Like, this is part of your
that's
role.
That's part of it. Right, absolutely.
Because I was going to ask about what the roles are here. And I do think that part of your role is to keep things on track.
Absolutely.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And actually, the role gets runaway reversed. And our other job, it often gets reversed. I'm the reminder.
Yes.
You're the
reminder. I remind you to
Mason.
Keep track. Yeah.
Look at that.
Well, what was I saying? A funny story about Monica.
Didn't she tell you were gay?
Oh, yeah. She told me I was gay. Well, it was funny. We were on the 13th floor of our dorms at Hofstra University.
Nice.
Thank you.
Yay.
Alma mater. Go Flying Dutchman.
No, they weren't.
Isn't that terrifying?
Yeah. Well,
my high school were Panda Bears.
We played against you guys, though, the NYU Violets.
Did we win?
We were the NYU Violets. I would hope that you won.
We were the Flying Dutchman. What is that? They won't tell you. They won't tell you.
We could have been the Tulips, and that would have been awesome. Yeah, yeah. The Flying Dutchman trouncing
our
Tulips.
Our show was, our college was founded by Hollanders.
Look at that.
So, Hofstra. But we were on the 13th floor, and we were doing our laundry, and out of nowhere, I just start talking to Monica. I said, Monica, you know, I can't be gay. And this was before I had any signed, sealed, and delivered proof. And Monica was like, why not? And all our friends except for Monica were gay. And I said, well, because a man, like you're sleeping with a man, and you go to sleep at night, and the man puts his arm around you, and he protects you from the world.
Mm.
And Monica said, is that your only reason? And I was like, yeah. And she goes, that's not true. Nobody can do that. And I was like, damn it.
Yeah.
And she was like, oh, Jane. And I was like, Monica, what? And she's like, you're so gay.
Oh,
and I said, I am? And she's like, I'm like, when did you know? And she's like, remember that time we auditioned at this for the Freshman Day show at Prendy, and I was a vending machine, and you were Huey, Dewey, or Louie? And I was like, that's the first day we met. And she went, yeah, I knew that.
Yeah, I knew that.
And I was like, oh, man.
That's what best friends
do. That's what best friends do.
Yeah.
Huey, Dewey, and or Louie.
Yeah,
it was one of them. It was one of them. So yeah. Then you put together, and I love these sites, I have to say, all of the Mobcaster and Kickstarter, and I just love that people are...
Indiegogo,
just these sites, and we've had a number of people on. We just had the folks on who are creating the It Gets Better, the musical project.
Oh, nice.
And that was an example of you give money, and you don't know how to budget, because you don't know if the money's going to go through or not. And theirs went through, and I think they raised about $25,000.
Wow.
Right quick. And I say because of our show, so...
Well, yes, there you go.
There we go.
Well, I would say that, too.
Yeah.
I think anything good that's happened in the world has been due to your show.
I think so. I think we are responsible.
The healthcare
was totally our show.
Gay marriage,
we were a little bit on the fence about.
Well, you don't want to give too much.
Yeah. Yeah,
too many rights get people.
Well,
a
we just don't want to take away all of our ability to complain, so it would leave me without a show.
As
we want a little edginess.
Yes.
As my sister-in-law told me one time when she was on a bender, I ruined the rainbow for her.
Ooh,
and it was me personally, and so I take credit for ruining the rainbow for straight people.
Wow.
Although I really don't think it was ruined. It just meant she couldn't put it on the back of her car anymore without people thinking she was gay.
I remember when I think I've told this story on the show before, when there was the big proliferation of those flags outside people's houses.
Yes.
Where it would be you're like a house with a sun behind it, or you know all those just silly flags that mean absolutely nothing.
Yes.
And my mom said, I saw this flag, I'm going to get a rainbow flag, and it looks so nice to put outside the house.
Yes,
I didn't have the heart nor the desire to tell her, no, Mom,
no.
Don't do that.
Thanks, Mom.
I thought that, oh, that looks really good.
Yeah.
Make sure it says peace on it, because that makes it okay.
That makes really peace.
So you are using Mobcaster, and we're going to link people. It'll be very easy right on our site. We'll be able to link right to your Mobcaster site, and we're trying to get $40,000.
Right, which is a very small amount of money to do a full pilot episode, but it's an enormous amount of money. To anybody I know.
So folks who are listening are thinking, all right, if I donate money, that's going to go, from what they're hearing, it's going to go towards new jeans for Jane Baker. And
Jane hasn't bought new jeans in 20 years.
All right, so it's not going to go there.
No.
I have a costume closet full of clothes.
Yeah, we don't need clothes.
Dress
full
up.
Of, like, clowns,
we totally should have dressed up for this.
You know, I am dressed up, and I can't believe you don't see a colonial Williamsburg costume when you see it.
I see it in your eyes. All right, so people are going to donate here, and what is the money going to go to?
The money will go towards the rental of equipment, video equipment, a director of photography, / cinematographer. The actors will all be from here, Vermont.
Great.
To shoot the pilot. And then we feed them. You have to feed them.
You
it's
do.
Courtesy.
They get hungry.
It's a courtesy.
But we're probably not going to pay them.
Well, no, they probably won't be paid.
We have an in there
in that lots of people want to get their hand in something from the ground. The assumption that I have was, well, I know this for a fact. There's an agent at CAA in Hollywood that Monica connected me with who's been reading my scripts as they evolve. She's currently looking at the latest draft and wants to look at a demo pilot. So it's really, the $40,000 would hopefully be able to accomplish a tight-looking episode, professional quality, but it would not probably ever air other than on Mobcaster.
Okay.
It would probably be along the model of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Sure.
Where they produced their own pilot, but then when the network latched onto it, they reshot the pilot at an enormous budget.
Right, but that was like how much? The
they made
Sunny.
they made the pilot episode, and it was for a half hour comedy, for about $25,000. That's what I
we can
read.
Do this for 40,000.
For 40, it's an hour drama.
What are you hoping that the show brings to people? Because we got to motivate people to give.
Right. Well, the two biggest things are these. I grew up hearing so much misunderstanding about my brothers, about what their disability meant. People assume you look a certain way, then you're not mentally there because you're not physically able. And it was just, I always wanted to be able to show people what our family was like in context, in our house, mm-hmm. like what it was like to be, to progress in a disease and have all these people around you that love you and it's breaking their hearts. But we nobody deserted them. I mean, we all stuck it out, and I think that's one of the big things. The other thing is that, you know, when people have a problem with somebody that's gay, they don't usually have a problem with them as a child because they never saw them as a child. They just see them as this person that popped up to piss them off and be gay at them. And yeah. It's just like, yeah. That's not how it happened. I grew up gay. I was an odd child in an odd family. I mean, I stood out. I knew I was different in ways that the fact that we were dealing with two brothers in wheelchairs kind of made you like a mini celebrities in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. And sort of, I knew I was weirder than that. I knew that something was more different than just that. And growing up and trying to figure that out, and you know, dealing with all the different things that you deal with as a child. Like, everybody disappoints their parents. It's just part of their job. But I disappointed my mother in an epic way.
Nice.
I was.
You go all out.
I did it in a really good way. I was the daughter my mother didn't want, but my sister was exactly what my mother wanted. Yeah. And, you know, I, praise God, kissed it up to God. I'm glad she got that.
Yeah.
Because she needed that. That was the daughter she needed. But I was the daughter my father needed, you know. And we were great, great, close friends. And I think that that's one of the main points, is that if you see someone as a child and see the world through their eyes, then it's much harder to just say, I liked her when she was helping her brother. I hate her now because she's gay.
Right.
It's like, exactly. It's like no, like people. They're two different people,
yeah.
Or they're not, or one didn't come out. I mean, like they're both at the same time.
Yeah.
I wasn't not gay then. And I'm not helpful to anybody
right,
now.
Right, exactly. That's
it's
great.
One person. And to see that kind of a character evolve, I was talking to somebody the other day about how towards the end of my brother Patrick's life, he found great comfort in watching The Waltons. Now, we grew up watching The Waltons. And, you know, what was it but simpler times? And, you know, you trusted your neighbors. And there was always just a nice story. I don't think my stories are all that nice. But I think that I would find comfort in a show that is set in the late 70s that reminds me of where I was when I was young.
Right.
And I think that there's always a place for nostalgia if it's done well. I mean, there was that 70s show, but it was kind of made up 70s.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of Sandy's
stylistic
biggest jobs, is to make sure that
authenticity,
that the clothes are
that's
correct, that the set looks right, that the cars are right, the right year. Because a lot of people assume if you're going to do a show and it's 1977, then that should be a 1977 Impala out front. When that's not how people live. You explained it better to me.
That's what I do over at New England Youth Theater. I'm sort of the dramaturge in terms of making sure that it isn't just every single thing on this set is, you know, from this period. You sort of, every single object has a story. Where did it come from? Did Grandma, you know, give that beat to you or but the other piece that I wanted to say was the sort of irreverent humor that you bring to it. And that's one part that I love when you write the dialogue for your two mm-hmm. brothers. Man, you get a real sense of these guys, their sense of humor, the irreverence around that, which there's, I mean, I that's something that's very different, handicapped people being portrayed.
Often they're portrayed as like pity me and I have no will or things like that, when that's not the reality. My brothers were in charge, and like they refereed every hockey game we had, and if you even doubted their call, you were out of the game. And they would just say things that nobody expected. There was a little girl down the street who insisted on jumping on the foot pedals of my brother Patrick's wheelchair. And he hated that because it made him feel like he could get pushed out.
Yeah.
And so she did it one time too many. And he said, please don't step on my foot pedals. And she said, I've always wondered, why are you in a wheelchair? And he said, because I'm the laziest person on earth.
Nice.
And she said, you could get up? And he said, I could get up. And if I do get up, I'm going to kick your ass.
There you go.
It was just like,
she did not step on that again.
No, no. And you had to have permission. You know those little things on the back of wheelchairs? I don't even know if they have them anymore, but we used to have to do them to get them up over the curb or something. Like, you had to have training.
Yeah.
On how to do that, and they would decide whether or not you were good enough to be able to do it. And then it was an honor to be able to lift 200 pounds over a curb, you know, for a little kid. It was just very funny. And their fights were, if you heard their fights, you would assume they were hitting each other because it was like that. But one time when we were all having breakfast, they got in an argument, Pat and Dave, and their hands were near each other like this, but they couldn't really move their hands much. And so, like, the intensity was mounting, and the insults were growing meaner and meaner. And my mother was in the kitchen, and she was keeping an eye on them. And at one point, Pat and Dave's got their pinkies entangled, and it was like everybody was like, they're watching. And we're all like, go, Pat, go, Dave. And my mother came in, and she went, no. And she moved their hands about 2 inches apart from each other. And that was the equivalent to throwing somebody into another room that was having like a real brawl. But it was like with the same intensity and the same amount of seriousness. We were all like, oh, this is bad. This is real bad.
Yeah. And I would say in the pilot, right off the bat, you get a sense of everybody's, or at least your parents' differences in humor.
Oh,
it's,
yeah.
And you do get the sense that this is a funny family because of this mother and father. And it does remind me a lot of Roseanne, which I love.
I love Roseanne.
And miss so much.
Yeah.
And it that's what it reminds me of, except it's the other piece of it is that I think it's so important for people to get a feel for what life was like before people were so out and what it was like for it just to start happening. So many girls, I work with teens a lot, don't have a feel for what life was like before feminism, so they don't even embrace that word.
Right.
So
and
in
they,
the same
gay
way...
Gay history is nothing to them.
Yeah, you've got to get a sense of it. And I think that's another big piece of this, is having a sense of what it was like to be 13 years old and not even know yourself because there's nothing out there to tell you
or
have a sense of it. So
right, and there was no place, I was talking to you earlier about this, there was no place when I was 13 that was like gay friendly. Gays are welcome here. Nobody was welcoming gays. And I remember I went to the library in my Catholic high school when I was 14 and looked up lesbian, and all it said was an aberration to God. And I was like, is this the Catholic dictionary?
Wow.
Because it was not... It was.
It could have said, like, please see none or something like that.
It
could have been
take book to none now.
Yes.
Right. Yeah, well, I...
Press alarm. None will run.
I remember closing the book and thinking, holy crap, I'm going to hell.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do that. And that sounds like a bummer.
See, we Jews
just
don't believe in
that.
We don't believe in it.
I don't care for the heat.
Yeah, no.
Brimstone. I don't know what it is, but it doesn't sound nice.
It doesn't smell good.
But instead, you went to theater. You went into theater.
Yes, instead I found myself at Upper Darby Summer Stage, which Tina Fey writes about in her book, as I forget what she calls it, but it was pretty much...
Yeah, Jane is actually in Tina Fey's book, too.
You're in Tina Fey's book as well.
She is Karen.
I'm Karen, of Karen and Sharon.
I've read it. I need to go back and read it.
I was
one of
her
lesbian friends.
The lesbian friends.
Oh.
I took her to her parties and stuff.
That's
we were
so fun.
We were just friends.
Also, I love Amy.
Yes, you love Amy.
We're going to have to figure this out.
I know what I was telling you earlier.
People are
going to... I love this.
People who know me are going to...
I love this.
It's fantastic.
This story. My mother, although we didn't always jive, was very protective of my fragile ego. And while I was in... I moved back. And Monica, by the time Monica was on Everybody Loves Raymond... I called my mother for some reason. We were talking. She said, oh, you know what? I saw Monica the other night on that show.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, she's doing great. And she's like, well, you know, you're better. And I was like, oh, thanks, Mom. But no, she's doing really, really great. And she goes, yeah, what is that? Everybody's awfully fond of Raymond. And I said, it's actually everybody loves Raymond. And she said, well, that's very presumptive.
Isn't it, though?
I said, no, Mom, literally, that's
honestly
the name
I
of the show.
I didn't love it as much. Like, I didn't love Raymond as much until Amy came on.
Well,
and Amy's mother on the show.
Isn't that beautiful? What a beautiful choice.
Georgia Engel.
Yeah.
Do you know I hate saying, I should be saying this out loud and people could take away my gay card for this?
What?
I have never seen one episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Oh. Really?
I've never seen it.
You're missing out.
I know.
You won't regret seeing it.
I know.
You can't
beautiful.
Really.
I love Georgia Engel.
Yeah. No,
but
I
you
love
can
her
never,
too.
Ever really appreciate the crazy of Mary Tyler Moore in Ordinary People until you've seen
So you're
her
saying
her
oh, right,
you're saying
true.
I should see Ordinary People then?
Yes, absolutely. If you want
to look, it's a sad day. Matlock died. I'm still still adjusting to that.
Yeah,
very upsetting.
You know what? 86.
Andy Griffith.
86 years old. I'll take
wow.
that.
Yeah.
That's a good long life.
I thought he was 86 in Matlock, so.
I know.
Really
isn't
quite remarkable.
I thought he was gone.
Really quite remarkable.
Yeah.
All right, so we're gonna link to the site. People, you can watch a video where I thought I was watching Crocodile Dundee. Totally not a real
not
Australian.
A real accent. No,
I had no idea.
No, I just was very excited for those Australian people running their campaign. They got 73,000, and I just thought maybe it's the accent.
Maybe it's the accent.
Why
so
not give it a shot.
People, don't be fooled. Not actual. There are no actual Australians in the show that
and
we
none
know.
Were injured.
And none
we
were injured.
Right,
none were
that
injured.
I know of.
But they might make some of the food for the actors. Who
I
we
wouldn't
should
mind
feed.
That.
All right. We'd be fine
I
with
like
that.
An Australian nice. Meal as much as
yes.
the next guy.
I don't even know. Oh, yeah, I don't even know what
is
that
it,
means.
What do they eat?
I don't
Let's know. Not even speculate. All right, no. we're gonna link to the site. We're going to link to the site. People are going to donate money. We're going to get to $40,000. They
so
have
cool.
6 hours left. No, how much do they have? Like,
I think it's 9 days.
It's good to say
nine
six
days.
Hours.
I think it's 9 days.
I thought it was
okay.
a little more than that, but that's okay.
Yeah.
That,
all right, we're going to get it going. We're going to get it going.
That puts a fire under people's tushies.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is, we think... We're not even going to look at Jane. Just you and I. People should fund this.
It's
this
incredible.
Is a unique voice.
Yep.
All right.
Yep. You'll
we
never
like
see
voices.
Like this.
We like unique voices. All right. Will you guys help me do? And not a lot of people get to do this. You're in very special company right now. 172 shows. Only a handful of people get to do the end tagline with me.
Holy crap!
I know. So you take deep breaths. Your key words, and you'll know when to do it. You shake it out. Shake it out. You will know when to say it, but your key words are so gay. So, you know, okay. as I'm finishing the show, you guys just keep rehearsing that over there, but no, it's coming up. No, it's coming up. All right, guys, that is it. That's it for this week's show. Okay, hold on. I got to do the end. I'm not ready yet. Yes, in your head. Use your quiet voices. That's it for this week's show. Get out there, folks. Drop us an email. Send an email on over to Ken at thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com. You'll see all the upcoming guests on the show, including Sophie B. Hawkins just booked.
Damn.
And that. Damn, I wish... I was her lover. I'm so excited. And then, of course, go to the Facebook. You have an account. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. Get out there. Open a bar where there's drag queens bowling.
That's
write cool. a pilot. Get it funded. Use your voice in the unique way that you know how to do to create more dialogue, to highlight different experiences. And while you're doing all of those things, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?